he tries to say, close your eyes and then go away. So he locked me in as the night begins. I see the teeth behind the smile. Metal ghouls haunt this broken child. It followed home and I'm not alone. Don't steal the breath from me tonight. I'm hiding with no means to fight. There's someone in the hall. I can't escape them all. I saw who killed these twisted souls. They only haunt the child who knows. Or are they in my head? The monsters under my bed.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Comic Pop Visits. I'm Richard, along with Lenny and Jonathan, and today we are visiting with D.C. McGannon and C. Michael McGannon, the writers of Charlie Sullivan and the Hunter Series series, and we're pleased to have you join us this evening, gentlemen.
Hey, it's good to be with you. Thanks for having us.
Hey there.
And we're going to be starting off with their Charlie Sullivan series, which most of us has either experienced to a degree, if not read most of the volumes. You are up to 3 volumes right now. You are working on the 4th. Do you want to get into some of the explanations on what's happening with that series so everybody that's out there will know what to expect that's coming forth and when they might expect the 4th, if you guys have a timeline yet?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the series started officially back in 2009. We wrote it back in 2005 and started publishing several years later. And now we've come to the point with our fan base and just with where we are as writers and where the series is going that we wanted to stop. We've got the first 3 books out, and we wanted to stop and take a break and go back and revisit those stories fresh. And so what we've done over the course of the past year is actually revised those stories. They've gone through another editing process, and books 1 and 2 especially have quite a bit of new material that's mixed in. It's not like there's this huge chunk that's just been dropped in, but it's mixed throughout. And I think you'll especially see that at the end of book 1 and just throughout the course of book 2. Book 3 stays pretty much the same. It's just been cleaned up and prepped for moving forward. So books 1, 2, and 3 are out, and as of this week, the revised versions are all available across all platforms, and we are looking ahead to book 4. That is currently being written and edited, and I want to say that I like to have it out before Christmas. I don't think that's going to happen, though, because Michael actually has another series that's starting before Christmas on his own. So
it's all forgiven. It's all forgiven.
Yeah, we're kind of you know, weighing in the balance there, because we also publish other authors as well. So I think right now we want to focus on this, focus on the new horror collection and what Michael's getting ready to launch. And I would say probably beginning of 2016, book 4, The Dragon Gate, is going to drop for the Charlie Sullivan series.
And I'm literally dying to read that book.
I got to be honest with you. The Dragon, because of where we are right now in the series and where it's going, books 1, 2, and 3 set up a lot of character development. You get to know a lot of people. You do some traveling. Books 4, 5, and 6... really drop the hammer big. And I'll give you a little bit of peek inside. The Dragon Gate is an actual real place in Japan where they go to. You can actually physically go visit the Dragon Gate. Some people call it the Demon Gate. But you can actually visit this place physically in Japan. Michael can tell you a lot more about the location. But that story is going to take place largely between Japan and here in the U.S., and there's a whole host of other characters that are introduced, and if I can just give a teaser, basically the entire world begins to crack. What were you going to say about the Dragon Gate?
I was just going to say you can go visit what's left. It's kind of one of the more interesting spots in Japan's history. the thing is maybe a piece of a stone left at this point, but that's actually going to play heavily into the story itself for us.
Nice.
How little of it is actually left.
Yeah, and this stone marker for the Dragon Gate is actually found in the middle of a child's playground, which
that's
makes
comforting.
It very interesting. Kind of spooky, but it's interesting.
Any children taken? Well, that's kind of a spooky little aspect
well, I mean,
of
that. That's part of the legend of it all.
Yeah, actually, that gate was a place where thieves were known to hang out, and it's a place where people would drop off their dead or unwanted. So a lot of bodies would go
would
missing.
Would you rather be the dead or unwanted? I don't know. just unwanted, please.
That's the location historically in Japan where Book 4 centers around a lot of its activity. However, what we've done with the story is we're not focusing on the history of that location so much as the story as it pertains to Charlie Sullivan and what's going on with them at that location. And if you read Books 1, 2, and 3, you know that a lot of the activity in the books take place around a portal city, a portal that leads to another dimension. So you can kind of put that in context and think about the Dragon Gate as another portal. However, this one is going to have much more significance as we race toward the rise of the ancients, which will begin to unveil themselves very quickly.
Oh, it's very exciting stuff.
I don't want to get Lynn all hyped up over there or anything. I hope he hasn't had any coffee tonight, but
well, he's kind of dancing right now, so he's getting excited. So
I don't think he's gonna need coffee.
I don't even need it. I'm very excited about I actually knew as soon as you said Demon Gate, I've actually heard of that place. I don't know from where, but it's like it rang a bell and I'm like, ooh, I want to go look that up on Google and see if I can actually look at it. Because, I mean, if the technology exists out there, then if it, you know, actually fine. Sorry.
There you go.
Yeah, with Google Earth, actually, you can zoom right in on that marker. And you can see the kids' playground, the office building nice. That it stands right next to.
Do you use the playground in the story? I got to know that.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah, you'll be able to see. And unlike, you know, Book 1... Hunter's Grove is a fictional location that takes place in a geographically accurate part of the U.S., but Book 2 takes place in Ireland, as you know, but we go deep into kind of a hidden area of Ireland, which is fictional. Book 3 is back in Hunter's Grove quite a bit, but this will be the first book where we actually stage in a historic physical location that you can look up. You can zoom in on Google Earth. You can go visit. We have pictures of it. We actually do an entire panel at conventions about the Dragon Gate in Book 4.
I have a belief that one day there will at least be a Hunter's Grove amusement park with a little Hunter's Key for me and the kids to go through. And
I like your attitude. Let's stick.
No, zooming in on Google Earth, that's not going to be like Ringo, and if we see something, we're in trouble.
Right? Yeah.
No, just relax.
Just relax? Okay.
He's been watching a lot of horror movies with us lately. So.
What was the name of that place again?
The Dragon's Gate. It's also called the Demon's Gate.
Demon's Gate.
Oh, Jonathan's looking it up. He's going to see if he can die. No.
High technology.
With your guys, when you were first starting out, whose idea and concept was Charlie Sullivan and the hunters themselves, the monster hunters? And was it Michael's? Was it yours, DC? And how much? I know it's a collaboration between both of you, but where was the germ began at?
I think that's actually DC's, like that's mostly DC's starting point.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it started about 3 o'clock in the morning. I had just kind of taken an early retirement, if you will, from what I had been doing for 20 plus years professionally. And I had written before. I had written professionally. I'd written fiction before, but never published anything. And a lot of my technical and even theological writings have been published elsewhere. But we were working a job together in the middle of the night, and I just said, you know, we both love to write. We both love to create. We need to do something together. And, you know, we worked every night for probably 3 years through the night together. So it was just me and him doing our job and getting to talk and flesh out these ideas. And, you know, I went back to something that George Lucas said a long time ago during his early
Star Wars. Throw in that Star Wars reference. There you go.
I won't let me because I don't have.
I don't know if you remember the statement that George Lucas had made about, you know, a special effect is nothing without a story. Special effects are boring without a story. And one of the things Michael and I love is monsters, folklore, legends, you know, the ghost stories and all that kind of stuff. And I said, so let's think about, you know, some stories that we can write with the things we love. But let's take it back a notch, because for us, the monsters would be those special effects. The monsters and the legends and the mythology would be the special effect. What we really need to focus on is the human aspect of a group of friends who are facing some unreal challenges, and can they get through those challenges together based on their friendship and their loyalty and getting over their differences and unifying. So the story of Charlie Sullivan, the Monster Hunters, was born out of the idea that people can come together from all different backgrounds, from all different nationalities, from all different diverse variables in their life, and they can overcome even the ultimate evil in the world if they just stick together and
which is the Varkalok.
So that's where it was born. We started fleshing out Charlie Sullivan and every character. It was like every night we were just talking through character and backstory and history and families. Every one of these characters, they have moms and dads and aunts and uncles. They have history. They have loss. They have heartache. They have there's full stories to every character.
You mentioned that, and it's kind of like what George Lucas did with Star Wars. You kind of started in the middle where you almost did the same, because you give a little bit of tease of the parents in a back kind of a background setting. Mm-hmm. And then you dive
and you've
right
made promises, DC. Don't forget that you've made promises about Locke. I want you to know that you've made promises to some people about Locke.
What I can tell you, another teaser on book four is the parents begin to take a little bit more prominence in the story.
Oh, okay.
You begin to get a little bit more backstory on their families. You see the bigger picture in books 4, 5, and 6, and you've seen hints of it and teasers of it in books 1 through 3, and now it all starts to come together and really paints a big, broad picture.
One of the things I like the most about the series in general, and especially about book 1, is that, you know, when these kids start out, they know something's wrong, and they're in school, and they're all kind of outcasts. They're not really friends. Some of them, in fact, are a little bit of enemies. And so then when they come together, it's out of a necessity that they feel to survive. And I think that it's real fun how, you know, their friendship was born, and it was like it was ordained, but, you know, they had to work at it. It wasn't just like, oh, we're five friends and we're going to go out and hunt monsters together, go Power Rangers, you know.
Right.
It was definitely much, and to me, much more real. And the development, without giving everything away, the development within those characters is very interesting, and that's part a real big part. Like, I know you have this overcast of the ancients rising, and it's also their rising, you know. They're growing up, and they're growing into these roles as monster hunters, and it's really fun how that kind of mirrors each other through the story.
Yeah, we always want to go back to the friendship between these five, and then of course their friendships with others. One of the things that stands out to me, I've worked with teens and families for over 20 years, and one of the things that always stands out to me, and it's unfortunate, is that a lot of times teenagers, children, young adults aren't given the credit that they're due a lot of times. And I think looking at Charlie Sullivan and this group of friends, you know, for me, a lot of it boils down to we need to learn to be mentors. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I'm listening.
I'm hearing this horrible noise, like you're attacking me with Gallagher or something.
Yeah, I was leaning back trying to grab a
That was just his chair.
But I think being able to look at this group of teenagers and say, you know what, they are credible voices. They have something to say, and we need to listen to them. And at the same time, the teenagers look at the adults that are in their lives and say, we need to listen to what they have to say. So it's a collaboration across generations as well as across diverse friendships. And I think that's an important message for us to get across.
And the fun thing is, if they don't listen to each other, they're probably going to all die.
You're right. Yeah.
Well, that comes close to happening in book two. I don't know about others, but
yeah, book three as well. Book three is.
Yeah, you haven't read that yet. I love it. Gangster.
I've only read the first one.
Yeah, Jonathan's the most behind. I'm second. Lynn, he's...
Leave me alone.
Yeah. I think if you've listened to some of our other podcasts, he's... I confess to being one, and I left it in there as being a book whore. So. He reads ravenously, so he's a lot ahead of us on a lot of things. So
I do read a lot. It's just sometimes it's got to catch my interest, and this one has caught my interest, but I just haven't had any time.
One of the things that I want you guys to also explain is, and this is kind of behind the pull the curtains back a little bit, DC and Michael and I have met two previous times. Lynn and them have met as well once. So we've talked previously. So I'm going to bring in some of those references. But you mentioned the artwork for your covers. I don't know. If you want to mention too much, because I know you said there's stuff that you want readers to find themselves. But do you want to mention the artist and what he's done for you and what the covers represent, besides just being covers for a book?
Yeah, absolutely. You want to take the lead on that one, Michael?
Yeah, actually, it's a very important part to us, because a lot of, and in the publishing world, in traditional publishing, most authors don't get any say in the covers whatsoever. So you might read a book, look at the cover, and think, what the heck does that have to do with the book? For us, we actually got to work with a good friend of ours, Matt D. Smith, who is a brilliant graphic designer. We've always called him the Wizard. But we got to work with him personally on each cover, and he basically took pieces and parts of the story and worked them into each cover separately. So if you go and look at the cover of book one or book two or book three, you can look at just the tiniest detail, and you will recognize it somewhere in the story. Everything is handpicked and very carefully considered on these covers.
I want you to think about something, too. Whenever Richard showed me the Varkalox diary, I thought that the artwork immediately, it caught my eye. It was exquisite, and it did. It showed that there was a lot going on in there, and I didn't know that it was going to have direct, you know, at the time, but I found myself, as I was reading the first book, trying to guess which shadow belonged to which kid. And at first it was a little bit difficult for a couple of them, and then I was like, okay, that's you. Yeah, I got you. And the last one I figured out was Charlie, and I think I have them all right now. That artwork was very drawing, and that guy, he's David Smith, you said?
Matt Smith.
He was just, he did a great job, and that's just astounding. You actually showed me a teaser of the Dragon's Gate, I think, back cover DC, and that piece of art was, all the art is really good. And yeah, I'm really glad you worked with him, because it's really helped.
Yeah, Matt's a great friend. He's just an incredibly talented individual in so many ways, and he's kind of taken this book series on as his own baby, almost as much as we have as authors. This is his baby, you know, in the artistic realm. And so it's like Michael said, every little piece and parcel that is on the cover has something to do with, even if you look down at Darcy's hand on book one's cover, you'll see something that she's holding that plays into a lot of prominence, you know, in the other world. And
I know what that is.
I don't think you guys do this live or anything, but we actually have a picture of that back cover.
Yes,
book four. That's the one. And there he is. There's my guy.
Bartholomew. I don't know if you guys can see that.
There's my dude.
Maybe listeners won't be able to see this right now. But
they won't be able to.
all I can tell you is that has some significant insight into what's about to happen. And this actually is on the back of book four, but this actually shows insight into book five. So you have characters from book four, but you almost start getting a peek into the next book with that book cover.
I'm really scared for the brownie. Can I say that?
As far as what DC just said about peeking into book five, I feel like we have to say we apologize ahead of time when you get there.
Thanks.
Yeah, and by the way, let me give one more shout out if I can. Matt Smith, you can find him at MD Smith Designs. We've got him on the inside cover, and he's listed, I think, on our websites, monsterhunters-thebook.com. But he doesn't do just book covers. He does artwork for music, for bands. He does artwork for Hollywood, some of the stop-motion graphics, I think is what it's called, for TV and movies. If it exists, he does it. And he's just a brilliant individual, and I can't say enough about him. So if anybody needs a book cover or a logo or branding material or anything, you give this guy a ring, because you see how much effort he puts into our small little book covers. You just imagine, you know, the time and effort he takes with people in branding and marketing, you know, your images. So we love him and look forward to every time he produces something.
And one of the other things I want to say, mentioning back to the book covers, is one of the aspects, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but how I viewed it, I love the silhouettes as well, but what I liked about them is, for a reader, whether you're a girl or a boy or a man or a woman, you could pick a silhouette and put yourself into that character's body, in a sense, and become that character a little more readily, since there's just a silhouette.
You have to have a silhouette to do that.
So, well, it's kind of like a blank mass, so you can actually...
No, I know what you're saying. I'm just like...
I kind of thought that was unique. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I had fun with that aspect of it.
Yeah, it was very intentional. We wanted readers' imaginations to take over.
Yeah, I don't think you ever... as writers, I don't think... You definitely have pictures in your head of every character as you're writing, but you want to let the reader paint as much as they can in their mind and let them take control of the story in that way.
But not too much, or you might get flooded with emails. No.
Well, as they're reading. Yeah.
These are problems we'd like to have.
We already have people who want to date some of these guys and girls. We already have people who are like, how do I find Darcy, or how do I find Nash, and what do I have to do to go out with them? You know, so it. But that's a great part of it, to know that people are identifying with these characters at that level.
Well, April's not here, but one of the things she says, she's pissed off at Darcy and Nash because she likes the Nash character and Darcy's not good enough. So
this is always the way with the April.
Right.
She's back in her play practice tonight, so she's going to be gone for the rest of this semester from us. So that's why she's not here. One of the things with the artwork, you gave us some teasers about a game related to this title as well. Is it the same artist that's doing the gaming cards, or is that somebody different? And do you want to go into that, or do you want me to cut this out? It's up to you.
No, we can go into that. The the game is developed. It's been through several plays.
Need any more testers?
that have tested this game. We took a break from the game because we knew we were going to go back and revise the books and move forward with the remainder of the series, because originally what was supposed to happen is each kind of upgrade pack for the game comes out with each book. Book one has a pack of cards, book two has its own set, book three, and so on. The artist that is doing the art for the cards is not Matt, who does the cover art. This is another artist who's actually out of Germany.
Oh, wow.
He's a world-renowned artist. He does stuff. I think he just had a whole spread, I think, in Popular Mechanics and Discovery or National Geographic or something. He's he's top shelf in terms of illustrator and artist, and he's been working with us from the very beginning on the artwork for the card. So he'll finish out all the character art and probably most, if not all, of like the tools and the magic and different things like that. But the cards will go back to the game and refocus on that in 2016 now that these first three books have been revised and re-released and we're moving ahead with the story again. Okay. We just didn't want the game to get ahead of the books because it would have been really easy to do that, and then it would have messed up the stories.
Could definitely understand that. So going back to the heart of it before you actually release them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? In this world, it's real easy to jump on all of your ancillary markets and try to run with those because people get excited about artwork and they get excited about games. But you know what? If we don't have the story, I don't think we have much else to work with. So we have to focus on the story.
I want you to focus on the story too, but I'm really excited about seeing those cards.
Lynn is like, just focus only on the story.
Just give me the story.
No. Like, I don't want the T-shirt. I don't want this card. Just write the freaking book.
But I will tell you this: I've played Magic: The Gathering since '94, believe it or not, and I was very young. I played it off and on, and I played it in a tournament 2 weeks ago. So, you know, I just I've never really gotten into any. Well, I can't say any. I have gotten into a few of less popular, almost unknown now TCGs. But when you said that you were using that kind of formula and coming up with your own TCG for this series, I was like, you know, I just very excited about that news.
And for those that couldn't see, he raised his hand, squinted his eyes, and just said, hey, without the A.
they have to actually animate me on air because I do a lot of silent miming, and they keep telling me, you're not on TV. And I keep telling them, yet.
Well, we're excited about the game. I guess it was about 3 years ago, Michael and I sat down, I think during the month of October, and Michael literally, this will show you how small we really are as independent authors. Michael literally hand cut an entire deck of cards from paper. Ooh, wow. And then hand drew every character and every piece of magic and every tool on those deck of cards so that we could play with it. then we went and bought card sleeves and put all those little hand-drawn pieces of paper in card sleeves so we could feel that we had the thickness of a card in our hand.
Please tell me you still have those proxies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We have all of them in pictures galore.
That's something I would like to see. That is something I would like to see one day.
It was a lot of fun. So going from that to this artist working with us, I actually I was in a rush on the way to a convention a couple of years ago, and I ran into Office Depot, and I took my file in there, and I said, I need you to print me some posters of this card super fast. And so the guy starts printing the cards in oversized form for us. And he says, wait a second. He said, this is the new deck of cards for Magic, isn't it? And I said, what? Excuse me? And he said, you're the one that – you have the new cards for Magic. And I'm like, listen, bud. Would I be an Office Depot off of a thumb
you
drive?
Wish.
I said, I appreciate it. I said, it really makes me feel good that somebody recognizes it at that level. But no, this is a very different game. But it made me feel good to think that somebody thought the art was that well done associated with our product. So it's gone from hand-drawn pieces of paper to somebody thinking that it was a Magic card. So we're pretty excited about that.
And this day and age, the Magic cards have world-renowned artists. I mean, they really – if you're being compared to them artistically, you can just go ahead and give your artist a good old slap on them. I haven't seen them yet, but I've seen a lot of new Magic cards, and they've got to be good if they're being compared with that. That's just –
Yeah, and he's amazing. He's done some exhibitions and stuff throughout Europe this past year that has really garnered him some international success. So we're really proud to be associated with all of these artists.
I've seen some of his newer stuff as well that he's released just the past few weeks, and I always look at it and think, dadgummit, I wish I had that idea.
With going to the conventions, is that how you met these artists, or how did you just know them? How'd you look into meeting these individuals?
No,
you're just tremendously blessed, and just
actually, I met Matt many years ago. His wife worked with me for a couple of years when I was working with a group of families and teenagers in Orlando. And when she met Matt, she was single when I was working with her, and then she got married. She and Matt married, and Matt and I just hit it off. Cool. And just started okay. hanging out. And I didn't even know what he did. I didn't even know what he did for a living. And then he started showing me some CD covers. And, you know, I'm huge into music and the artwork for music. We've produced several bands in the past. And then I just said, listen, here's what we're working on. I said, I'm going to give you a copy of the manuscript. And if you feel like it's something you want to be a part of, you let me know. And if not, no hard feelings. And he called me back like 2 days later and he said, I want to do the covers for these books.
Very cool.
And so that's how I met Matt. And I think, Michael, you found Jacob just searching for artists.
Yeah, I did. And yeah, it was kind of interesting because of, you know, the gap between US and Europe. But I saw some of his work. I had tried talking with a couple other artists at the time, and unfortunately, the other artists that I found kind of in the same place were not very friendly at the time.
Yeah,
but Jacob was.
Well, they say artists can be temperamental. So, you know.
Well, yeah.
What are you saying?
I don't know.
What are you trying to say, Kyle?
When you meet a good group of guys or ladies, it clicks and it's fun.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well,
there are times when it doesn't.
You immediately see the talent that Jacob had. And then we, you know, some of the ways that he described his own art, we were like, well, that fits perfectly for what we're looking for. So emailed him, almost did not, like, I guess it was an older website or something that he used for clients, and almost did not get in touch with them. But he emailed us back and was like, yeah, that sounds fantastic. What do you want me to do a test picture on? And we had him do the first, I think Charlie was the first card that we had him create, and we just was like, yeah, that works.
Yeah, well, there's two versions of Charlie. There's Charlie just
and
as a normal
red
kid.
Charlie.
There's Charlie with the red eyes.
Yeah. And there's Charlie Brown.
You know, when he's using the sight. And when he sent that artwork back to us, my jaw was just dragging on the floor for the whole day. So it's been a, you know, we are blessed in terms of the artists that we have been privileged to work with.
That's cool.
Well, they also know they're working with some talented writers, so that doesn't hurt your chances with them either.
I hope so.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Can I ask, how did you end up developing some of your characters? Like, some of the names, some of the teachers' names that you came up with, I found really, really funny. And I thought they were just awesome the way that you came up with them.
Yeah, you want to take that one?
Well, I think, actually, DC came up with a lot of them. But, I mean, some of them, it's kind of cheesy. Whenever I'm creating a character, I usually try to, I personally like to find meaning in names. So, Leave and Lisa, for me, I got to name those two characters, and Leave means lion, and Lisa means fox in Russian. And for me, those were very, you know, they kind of described their characters for me. Lisa's very cunning, very intelligent, and Leave is very
grand.
He is, and he's very lion-hearted when you see some of the sacrifices he's willing to make for the people he loves. And you know, some of the other characters, like the teachers, I think were from almost personal experience. I don't think we named
we didn't name anybody specific, but there are some influences from particularly my junior high school years with teachers and with adults in our influence at that time. But a lot of those names and everything, like Michael said, we really thought through and said, you know, like Charlie Sullivan, for instance, Michael and I, and this is inside knowledge here, nobody I don't think really knows this, but Michael and I both share the name Charles.
Okay.
And name is in both of our names somewhere. And so, you know, and then, you know, the rest of the name has was developed from a very important person in my life, who is a dear close friend, and I think his character and his honesty and everything about him just spoke to me that this is what Charlie's about. You know, Charlie's about honesty. Charlie's got character. He makes mistakes, but he's going to get up and keep walking. And so we look at people in our lives, and, you know, we look at, like Michael said, the definitions of names from various heritage. And, you know, that's how those names come to be. Some of them are just silly influences from funny things that have happened in our lives, but
Fish and Dink, I don't know if we can explain that one.
Yeah, Fish and Dink.
I had a question about those two guys.
Yeah.
And I assume they are, but I was just curious. I know that they carried on into the story much further than I thought that they were pretty much dead as soon as they went through the gate. The gate at Hunter's Grove,
right.
In book one. And so, you know, like the fact that they're still kicking monster butt by book three, I'm just curious, you know, I hope I'm going to see them again in book four. Is that something that you can divulge? Are they going to stay? I mean, I know they're not prominent characters, but they're one of my favorite sidelines for sure.
I don't want to say what happens to them, but you will see Fish and Dink again.
Nice.
Fish and Dink Carver Mysteries.
Fish and Dink have actually become a very prominent fan favorite, group of fan favorites there in the books. Even for the little amount of time that you read about them, they've had a pretty big impact.
I can see why. They're fun, and yeah. They're very paternal, and they're very caring, and you can see that caring. They care for these kids, and they don't have to be normal, and they don't have to be, you know, important in the city and respected by society to do what they've got to do to try to protect and do what's right. And I love those characters. I've known people like those characters, and yeah. they really spoke to me. They had a lot of in a very short period, like you said, they weren't in a lot of scenes, but they do a great job of
endearment.
Exactly. They're very endearing characters.
Yeah.
I think you hit a cool little nail on the head with that when you said they don't have to be normal. And I feel like they don't have to be special either. They don't fit in with the normal folk. But they're not the monster hunters either. They're not the elite monster hunting specialists. They do what they think they need to do, and they're there for the people they care about.
They very much carry the servant heart. In a lot of ways, you know, they're quirky, they're funny, they just want to go fishing and be done with the day, you know, but at the end of the day, they're going to do whatever they have to do to serve people that they care about. And again, that's one of those messages I think in these books that's important to us, that if we as human beings, no matter what we're like, if we would be willing to serve one another, our world would spin a lot better.
True.
Peace,
and I think being them wanting to go fish and all that, I think that's where I got that aspect of they're the hillbilly aspect. They're just good old boys. They're just, you know, they're part of the community. So
I'm glad you brought that up, Michael, because I agree with Richard 100%. They don't have to be, it's like you said, they don't have to be normal and they don't have to be special. They're unique, but they're not Superman. And they, I think, the bravery, you talk about the bravery of Liv and he's very brave, very lionly, but the bravery of these two regular fellas that have no special gifts, they are given some somewhat special guns later on, but they're just willing to go out there and face true horrors, you know, just on the strength of their character. And that it's a very interesting,
my mind went to a different place. Shortened that word too much.
And all the while they're looking at the horrors,
I'm shaking my head at Richard. So everyone out there knows I'm shaking it very vigorously.
I'm sorry, guys. Sorry, Michael.
I think we can stop now, Lenny.
Thank you.
I guess I missed something. I see Richard over there laughing his head off, but I don't know what happened.
Oh, when Lynn said horrors, my brain...
He didn't hear that last R.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
He heard another word.
Wrong book.
That's actually a different title called The Adventures of Fish and Dink After Hours. No, I'm just kidding.
by the shore. There we go.
Okay, I feel dumb now because I just barely got what you were thinking.
It's all right. It just hit me. I'm the only one that got it. So
wow.
Tell
you
what,
you're totally disturbed.
And I'm the last one to get it. So
on the, just to go down a different path before we jump into some of your other stuff, it is getting close to the month of October. And this is one of Lynn's favorite months, one of my favorite months, and I would assume one of your gentlemen's and family's favorite months. Do you have any special plans?
We live for October.
I was going to say, any special plans?
And it's not just for The Walking Dead.
Right. Actually,
you know, normally we're off doing a convention over the weekend of Halloween, and it's been that way for a lot of years, and we took some time off from the convention circuit this year to focus on writing and get some of those things taken care of. So we actually, I think, are going to be home for Halloween this
awesome.
Year.
Cool.
And we were just talking yesterday. We're going to start decorating, putting up the Halloween tree, and
Halloween tree.
We're building a grunt costume for Halo for our little guy.
Cool.
And so we're just going to do a lot of the family type stuff. We're going to do some parties. We've got some local events, a couple of book signings and different things like that that's around Tulsa or close by. And so we'll be pretty close to home and really just going to be beefing up the Halloween season the way we like to.
Just out of curiosity, what is a Halloween tree?
Do you put up a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
Sometimes. You put up a Halloween tree.
Okay.
It's a dead one.
Yeah. A dead one. Dead okay. One.
They just don't bother to throw it out after so many years. It's just like a Christmas tree, but it's not green anymore.
Okay.
And it usually has awesome. Some sort of vermin.
A Halloween tree is where it begins.
Okay.
Some of the stuff you've kind of mentioned it as already. The convention scene, you've guys been to many, and that's where I first met you gentlemen and mm-hmm. was excited to pick up your book. And do you want to kind of go into some of the unusual things that happen to you at conventions? You kind of alluded to that because some of the fans wanting to know where the characters are actually live, but have some interesting stories you might want to share, or do you just want to kind of quietly pass over that?
Michael, I don't know what kind of stories you want to bring out, but when we go to the conventions, here's the thing about us. I think that's a little different than a lot of people. When we're invited or when we ask to be a part of something, either way, we go as fans.
Well, you guys have fun.
We have a blast. When we go there, we want to have fun. We know that we're there to entertain. We know that we're there to sometimes educate. Sometimes I do talks on bullying, the issue of bullying, which gets pretty intense because it's an intense and important topic. Sometimes we're doing stuff on the books. We also DJ. We do live DJ. So there are times when we DJ the events, dance or rave. And a lot of times, you know, if we're not doing a panel or we're not doing a dance, you're going to find us walking around just as a couple of fanboys just having a blast.
Incognito.
And it really is. We try to get together with friends and just go shop the vendor's room and go to panels ourselves. And I don't see conventions so much as an event that we go and we have to be the main event. I think we go to conventions and have a blast. You know, we've got Wizard World Tulsa coming up here, Tulsa Comic Con coming up again next month, and that's one of the bigger conventions that we do close by. And you know, last year we had two or three panels that were standing room only.
Yeah,
and I mean, just hundreds of people, you know, in the room with us, and we're just having a blast. I mean, we're laughing our heads off and having fun, just as much fun as the people in the audience. And I think for us, that's what it's all about. If we can go to conventions and just have some fun, because you know what? These people pay a lot of money to get in the door. And so we want to bring a high level of entertainment, which I think we do. But we also want to be able to know that we want people to know that they can come talk to us. They can hang out with us. And you know, we're not untouchable. We don't have a handler that's going to get in between us. We're we're hanging out, and we want to go hang out with you. So I think for me, some of the silliness is, you know, like I was in line getting food at a convention last year, and I usually wear my cowboy hat or I have a bandana or something else. I'm just kind of that old school rock and roll, let's make it happen type of guy. This girl walks up to me and she's like, "Are you Axl Rose?" Axl Rose?
You bet, sweetheart. That's
how. She's like, "Well, the cowboy hat and the bandana, I didn't know if Guns N' Roses was here." And I'm like, "Holy cow." But it's a lot of fun. You know, I think getting able to see some of our favorite groups and our favorite artists is just a blast for us.
And it also lets us ram about what we're passionate about. I think we've become known as the monster guys at most conventions we go to. And I know for me, at least, I don't know about DC, but it's really fun when we have some of our later night and later on into the day panels where we talk about monsters, and then people linger for an hour to 2 hours just asking us questions. And it's been fun during some of those smaller conventions when the staff you know, doesn't like kick us out. We don't have anything behind that. And people just stick around sessions. And ask, "Have you ever heard of this?" Or "Have you ever heard of that?" Or "What do you think of this?" And it lets us get down and just have a conversation with people.
And I don't know if you know who Suzanne Lambden is.
Yes.
She's one of the authors we work with. A lot of conventions we do with her. And our tables, we request that our tables butt up against each other, because we'll end up getting out in front of our tables and having zombie fights, and, you know, wrestling matches, or we'll tag team people walking by and force them to come over and hang out with us or something. So it really is just about having fun and being a part of the fan community.
DC and Michael, we appreciate you visiting. We're going to actually have to put this in two parts. We're having a fun time here, and I'm glad that the gentlemen are willing to sit with us. I think you guys are willing, I hope.
Yeah, we're having fun. It's good to see you guys again. It's
definitely
been a couple months.
Definitely. So we're going to close out. Be sure to check out the DC and Michael McGannon's websites, monsterhunters-thebook.com or monsterguys.com. You can visit us and send us emails at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. If you can't get a hold of them that way, send them through us, and we'll forward them to them as well, because we want to get these guys out there, and because they're putting out quality material for everybody out there. But we've been having fun. We'll be back here shortly. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good evening.
Bye.
See ya.
Thanks, guys.
See you guys.